Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Dogs Program. We are the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools Program, and we're here every week to defend and promote public education, as well as standing for the absolute separation of church from the state. We have a big program this week, so without any further ado, I'll pass over to Andy for our press release. Over to you, Andy.
And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools Press release number 1048, The Plight of Religious Liberty in America. Reflections on the First Liberty Commission Meeting by Rachel Laser. The following article by the President of Americans United and CEO Rachel Laser originally appeared in the July-August issue of Americans United Church and State magazine. Poet and civil rights activist Maya Angelou famously said, "When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time." I was reminded of those words when, on June the 16th, I was reeling with all sorts of emotions from attending the first meeting of President Donald Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. President Trump had established the commission, which he housed at the Department of Justice, through an executive order he signed on the National Day of Prayer on May the 1st, 2025. Notably, in his somewhat incoherent remarks at the signing ceremony, Trump was dismissive of the separation of church and state. "They say separation between church and state. I said, all right, let's forget about that for one time." While attacks like this on church-state separation are all too common these days, let's commit to pause and feel outrage every single time the President of the United States degrades this foundational principle. Though Trump's executive order didn't mention Christianity, the fact sheet explaining the commission rooted its existence in the previous administration's targeting of peaceful Christians while ignoring violent anti-Christian offences. Infiltrating the commission. Though these meetings by law are required to be announced and open to the public, I was still surprised when I signed up, indicating AU as my organisational affiliation, and got in. While leading Americans United for 7.5 years, I have not prioritised attending meetings hostile to our issue. My schedule is already extremely full of actions to build our movement. But I have always wanted to witness such a meeting, to see the body language and hear the words live, rather than just reading about them or watching them on my computer. So, dressed in a blue suit with the Americans United logo and the American flag pinned to my lapel, I headed to the Museum of the Bible, the location of the meeting. There, with multiple American and Department of Justice flags waving in the background, I observed the commission members shamelessly advance three Christian nationalist myths. A trio of Christian nationalist myths. The first was the idea that America is a Christian country. This government meeting opened with, you guessed it, a prayer in Jesus' holy name. I wondered how Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, the one non-Christian on the commission, felt at that moment. Soon, Carrie Prejean Boller, former Miss California USA, until she was stripped of her crown for alleged breaches of contract, who was sitting directly next to the rabbi, was pronouncing, quoting America's first Supreme Court Chief Justice, "It is the duty to prefer Christians as rulers." It was impossible to take the next commission member seriously when he spoke about a robust scope for religious liberty. The second Christian nationalist myth I heard repeatedly was the idea, as articulated by Commission member Kelly Shackelford, President and CEO of the Christian nationalist group First Liberty, that our freedoms, our rights, come from God and no government can take that away. This mentality, when applied to Trump, whom many Christian nationalists believe is God's vessel for their agenda, means that Trump can do no wrong, even when he is violating the Constitution. Under this reasoning, religious extremists can justify violence, upending our democracy, and discriminating against and harming people in the name of God. The third myth that arose again and again was the notion, echoing the Commission fact sheet, that, as Commission member and longtime TV host Dr. Phil McGraw put it, today religious liberty for Christians is under assault. Some Commission members spoke of unjust laws, where even religious exemptions would not be a not sufficient remedy. Others spoke of the problem of the naked public square, where religion is not welcome. The irony is that Christians do fine when it comes to religion in the public square, from In God We Trust on money to every session of Congress opening with a primarily Christian prayer. It's religious minorities and the non-religious who are generally trampled on or excluded. I must confess that I only managed to stay for a few hours, leaving before Attorney General Pam Bondi addressed the commission. I had heard enough. It's critically important to keep fighting for church-state separation right now. Perhaps you too can take inspiration from these powerful additional words of Maya Angelou. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Rachel Laser is the President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and she is coming to Australia between the 17th and the 31st of October 2025 at the invitation of the National Secular Lobby. Rachel believes that the work of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU, has never been more important than it is today. She argues that Christian nationalism in the US is a serious threat to religious freedom and the separation of church and state. She has written op-eds for The New York Times, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, PBS Newhouse, CNBC and ABC News along these lines. Americans United brings together people of all faiths and of no religious faith to fight in the courts, legislatures and the public square for freedom without favour and equality without exception. She was raised as a Reformed Jew and understands why US laws should treat everyone fairly and equally. She is a graduate of Harvard University and the University of Chicago Law School. She and her husband have three children. During her career, Rachel has built bridges between disparate groups on a host of issues relating to church-state separation. As the Deputy Director for the Religious Action Center of Reformed Judaism, Rachel ran interfaith campaigns on LGBTI plus equality, immigration reform, gun violence prevention, and paid sick family and medical leave. She directed the culture program at Third Way, a Washington, D.C. progressive think tank specializing in understanding and reaching political moderates. Dogs are looking forward to meeting her when she arrives in Australia in October. Back to you.
Thanks for that, Andy. Yes, this program, we're going to have a look into the separation of church and state issue because it has a lot to do with what happens within our schools. But we'll have a quick break and we'll be back with more dogs after this.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook!
Did you know that 3CR received its community radio license in 1976?
Our application was successful because of our diverse and engaged community membership.
Subscribers are at the heart of our station, and we really need you to be active and paid up in 2023.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
Call 03 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Welcome back to the Dogs program. If you've just joined us, we're the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now we're going to look a little bit further into some of the machinations around funding of religious schools, and that's funding with your tax dollars. Now, Brindabella Christian College has, been trading insolvently for a long time, but I'll pass you over to Sorrel, who will tell us more.
Thanks. This article is written by Kate Medena and is titled Brindabella Christian College May Have Been Trading Insolvent for Years, Administrator Finds. The administrators of Brindabella Christian College in Canberra's north say the school spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on an overseas trip and a robot dog, while it may have been insolvent. Deloitte was called in as administrators of the college in March. In a 113-page report to creditors, its investigations show $330,000 was spent on a robot dog and donations were made to a political party using a company credit card. Deloitte also suggested the school was likely insolvent from at least January 2021. From as early as March 2018, concerns were raised by the business manager and principal with members of the board, they said. From October 2020, the company constantly failed to lodge its tax lodgements in time. The administrators identified about 200 creditors who were owed more than $12 million. Staff were also not paid their superannuation during this time, prompting the issue of a penalty notice. Five individuals, including three board members, took an overseas trip to the United States in April 2024 to secure the purchase of a Boston Dynamic Agile Mobile Robot. They also spent 5 days at a board retreat and 3 days at the Kentucky Derby. Deloitte puts the total costings at $460,000, which includes $336,556 spent on the robot and training, $69,810 on flights, and $39,053 on accommodation. Deloitte noted that undertaking happened at a point when the company was subject to significant financial distress. These costs were incurred at the time when the company was clearly insolvent and had accrued $2.1 million in unpaid super guarantee payments, Deloitte said. The robot was not a core operational requirement and had no clear link to the college's curriculum or educational outcomes. Carol Matthews is the Independent Education Union of Australia's New South Wales and ACT branch secretary, representing many of the college's teachers. I think at the time, our members were really upset and frustrated about what the way the school was being managed, but I'm sure they didn't understand the full extent of the problem, she told ABC Radio Canberra. What this report shows is the true cost of it and how that contrasted with the ongoing financial difficulties the school had over this period. Deloitte also found the college made political donations, which as a registered charity, they are prohibited from doing. Between 2021 and 2024, around $30,000 in political donations to the Liberal Party were charged to the company's corporate credit card, Deloitte said. Deloitte raised issues about the college's forward invoicing process, where an 11% discount was given for early fee payments. Deloitte said this was done without proper recognition of this in the company's accounts. Providing a significant discount on annual fee revenue for FY25 further exacerbated the financial strain, leaving the company in a position from which it could not realistically recover, Deloitte said. There's real questions about the practice that developed of encouraging parents to pay fees in advance at a discount and then showing that in the year in which they were received, even though there would be a liability to provide the education in the following year, Ms. Matthews said. The Deloitte report said the college failed to maintain company records, stating that bank reconciliations were not regularly completed across all accounts, and they were regularly behind in their various tax lodgements. It was not possible upon our appointment to run accurate reports detailing the amounts owed by families for tuition, Deloitte said. Furthermore, they noted that the position of accountant was vacant and the college's finance function was under-resourced and not completing core requirements and key tasks. Deloitte's report also notes the college's failure to address show cause notices issued by the government. ACT Education Minister Yvette Berry issued the school with a show cause notice, a formal document detailing alleged non-compliance issues during a disciplinary process, which allows the recipient to explain why disciplinary action should not be taken on the matter in February of this year. In April, Deloitte announced the school would be taken over by education provider Christian Community Ministries. They purchased the college for $30 million, which Deloitte said has helped to ensure creditors could receive all of what they're owed. The Boston Dynamic Agile Mobile Robot was included as part of the sale. Ms. Matthews said she was hopeful. "We expect things will go very smoothly with them," she said. "It's clear from the creditor's report that any outstanding liabilities we met in full. So that is a good place for the employees." Deloitte is recommending creditors vote to put the company into liquidation. Now the school is being run by a new operator. Back over to you.
Thanks, Sorrel. Well, this is the problem with turning schools into business ventures. Business ventures are for making money, not for educating children. And unfortunately, anytime anyone suggests we look into the funding of religious schools with government money, we get, of course, the Catholic schools crying poor. And last week we heard Henry Rajendra talking in the New South Wales Teachers Federation addresses, just suggesting that, hey, maybe we should look at how we fund religious schools. And of course, the Catholics have lost their mind. I'll pass you over to Andy for this one.
And this article is from the Catholic Weekly. "He doesn't think we should exist. New South Wales Education Secretary slammed," written by Tara Kennedy, published on July the 21st, 2025. Catholic Schools NSW CEO Dallas McKinney has criticised New South Wales Education Secretary Murat Dizdar during the 2025 Catholic Schools New South Wales Education Law Symposium, responding strongly to comments Dizdar made on ABC's Australian Story in April. In the program, Dizdar questioned the ongoing necessity of non-government schools in New South Wales, suggesting that the existence of private schools should be debated and discussed. Dizdar's comments come after state schools reported a drop of 25,000 enrolments over the past 3 years, with the Education Secretary declaring he'll be aiming to get those students back into the public system. "He," Dizdar, "could not be more wrong," McKinney said, criticising Dizdar's decision to raise the issue on national television rather than in a departmental meeting or a teachers' conference. McKinney wasn't alone in his condemnation. Shortly after the program aired, Dizdar also received criticism from others working in the private school sector. "It's outrageously bad and very worrying for Catholic education," McKinney said. He took the occasion when the eyes and ears of the country were on him via the national broadcaster to raise this question for us. "It's a monopolistic provision of schooling in this state where all other providers in New South Wales under Murat's vision are swept aside, done away with, and can't exist." Although Dizdar issued a statement 36 hours later, acknowledging the role of non-government schools, McKinney called it a forced retreat. He didn't disavow his position. He said some calming, clarifying and comforting words back into the public sphere, McKinney said. "When the most senior official of education in this state goes into the cabinet and gives advice on schooling in this state, he doesn't think we should exist." McKinney said if all schools were to become public, not only would it displease parents looking for a faith-based education, but would come at a cost of $5 billion each year to the taxpayer. He said it would also negatively impact students of lower socioeconomic status, SES, backgrounds, as they are more likely to attend Catholic schools offering higher retention rates than public schools. "This is what you risk when you have a monopoly provider of anything, much less school education. You are drawn down to the lowest denominator," McKinney said. "Whether it's lower year students, First Nation students, the funding, the fiscal position of the budget, parental choice, under a monopoly provider, all of these things are put at risk." McKinney's comments come at the beginning of the Catholic Schools New South Wales Education Law Symposium, an annual conference for the state's Catholic teachers to listen to speakers, network and gain insight into their field. The speakers at the symposium include New South Wales Premier Chris Minns, Bishop Daniel Maher and NESA CEO Paul Martin, among others. My reaction is, of course, Mr. McKinney is not alone in espousing free market ideology to criticise the provision of state-funded public education for all. It's hard to find evidence to back his position, though. It's the ongoing stripping of resources from the public system to fund private schools, including Catholic schools, that is, in fact, the greatest risk to quality school education for all Australians. And as for choice, what parents choose, and indeed deserve, is the provision of quality education for their children, regardless of their ability to pay.
Thanks for that, Andy. And it is important to note that the Catholic Church is quite literally one of the richest organisations on the planet. So it's a bit disingenuous for them to cry poor and ask for more taxpayer dollars when our public schools are doing the hardest lifting with the most disadvantaged students while never actually attaining 100% of the schooling resource standard, which was a standard that was set over a decade ago as the absolute bare minimum a school needs to do its job. And none of our public schools get 100% of their SRS. Yet, surprisingly, no surprise, the private and elite religious schools, they are getting up to 110% of their SRS. And that includes your tax dollars. But yeah, the public schools are the ones doing the heavy lifting, just as this article from New South Wales shows. Of course, significant rises in disadvantaged students in public schools, because public schools can't say, no, we think your child's educational needs are best met elsewhere, like the private schools can. Public schools have to take all comers. Over to Andy.
New South Wales schools see big rise in number of disadvantaged students. And this was written by Brett Henneberry and published in The Educator on the 25th of July. A quarter of New South Wales schools are now classified as high concentration disadvantaged, alarming new data shows. An analysis presented by former State and Commonwealth Education Department head Michelle Bruninges at the New South Wales Teachers Federation annual conference earlier this month found that local schools, local decisions devolved major financial and staffing decisions from the New South Wales Department of Education to individual schools, untethered to student need. The data shows 9% of New South Wales students now attend high concentration disadvantaged schools, nearly double the proportion since 2017, with New South Wales overrepresented nationally among high disadvantaged schools. New South Wales Teachers Federation President Henry Rajendra says policy has created a two-tier education system where disadvantaged students are denied the support they need. Every day we delay dismantling local schools' local decisions is another day millions in funding flows through a system that is failing students and burning out teachers, Rajendra said in a statement. We're seeing teachers and principals handling a threefold increase in students with disabilities while grappling with 1950s era support systems. The New South Wales Teachers Federation is now calling for the complete dismantling of local schools' local decisions and its replacement with a centralised response focused forensically on the needs of all students, including those from disadvantaged communities. The motion demands immediate conversion of flexible funding into permanent staffing entitlements, centralised allocation based on student need, additional support for schools with high concentrations of disadvantaged students, 2 hours additional release time per week for all teachers, and a systematic reduction in class sizes. A new model is creating an SSP within an existing school. Disability advocate Dr. David Roy, who is a lecturer in education at the University of Newcastle, says while public school systems have beautifully packaged plans for equity and excellence, the real-world experience for families in schools is that it depends on the leadership of individual schools as to how children are supported. An empathetic, understanding principle makes a difference, Dr. Roy told The Educator. There are some great schools that see all children as valued and of being stretched, but there are still too many instances of children with a disability being left as an afterthought or being not seen as deemed worthy of being stretched and recognised in their capabilities. Dr. Roy said this is also true for Schools for Specific Purpose, SSP, which can be excellent or at times a dumping ground where children are not educationally stretched. There is, of course, great practice also happening in the independent and Catholic systems where they have recognised a community need to support children with a disability, he said. A new model is creating a SSP within an existing school. This allows students with a disability to be part of the wider mainstream school, participating in mainstream school events and sharing many mainstream school classes. The irony, says Dr. Roy, is that for many of the low-cost independent schools to gain funding to support children, they need to create a new SSP rather than have a fully inclusive mainstream school. The funding model set up by repeated governments forces the expansion of a segregated system, he said. Concerns remain as to what happened in some segregated settings, as just with early childhood centres, those children who are most vulnerable and lack communication skills are the most in danger of maltreatment. Dr. Roy said, given the horrific revelations from for-profit early learning centres, the call for CCTV in the classroom has returned. We want both our children to be safe, but also our staff safe from false allegations. CCTV is one tool that can support this.
Thanks very much for that, Andy. We've had a big chunk of information for you, so I think it's time we have a little bit of a break. We'll be back with more dogs after this.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
For 3 years, teachers have had their qualifications, their pay, their pensions, and their working conditions attacked relentlessly by this government.
I'm the proud product of government-funded primary school education and of a government-funded secondary school education.
Australia is one of the richest and luckiest countries in the world, and there's no reason whatsoever why we can't have the very best public schools in the world.
It's still not good enough that kids with disability miss out.
Our education is not for profit. Our education is not for profit.
You're listening to The Dogs, the defence of government schools on 3CR.
And welcome back. If you've just joined us, this is the Dogs program, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now I'm going to pass you to Jeff, who's going to take us into the maelstrom that is American public education. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. If you'll indulge me, I'd like to open up with a quote from William Burroughs. He says, "I'm not a dog hater. I do hate what man has made of his best friend. The snarl of a panther is certainly more dangerous than the snarl of a dog, but it isn't ugly, because a cat's rage is its own, beautiful, and all its hair standing up and crackling with blue sparks, eyes blazing and spluttering. But a dog's snarl is ugly. A redneck, lynch mob, packy basher snarl. The snarl of somebody who's got a kill a queer for Christ sticker on his heap. A self-righteous, occupied snarl. And when you see that snarl, you're looking at something that has no face of its own. A dog's rage is not his. It's dictated by his trainer. And the lynch mob is dictated by their horrible conditioning." The reason I'm using that quote, that's the end of the quote, the reason I'm using that quote is the snarl of the white Christian nationalists in the United States is not their own. It's being dictated by a group of people who are conditioning them to encourage hate, and the rise of the hate groups in America is large, and I'm going to come to that in a minute. First, I'm going to talk to you about a bit of news which appears in The 74, which is America's education news source, apparently. It is it's called The 74 because 74 million Americans are under 18, and it's about education. And this article is in the news from July 25th, 2025. It's by Linda Jacobson. And it's "The Education Department Lifts the Freeze on Remaining Federal Funds. Advocates say they want to make sure it doesn't happen again." A freeze on federal education funding that prompted two lawsuits has been lifted, and the states will be able to access the money next week, the US Department of Education announced Friday. The White House Office of Management and Budget, OMB, which argued that districts were spending the money to advance a radical left-wing agenda, has completed its review of five different programs totaling $5.5 billion, said Madison Biederman, spokeswoman for the department. The funds support education for English learners and migrant students and pay for staff training and extra instructional positions. The news came a week after the administration released over $1.3 billion for summer and after-school programs, which was also held up for review. The department alerted states June 30, one day before they expected to receive the money, that the review was in process, forcing programs to cut staff and end summer programs early. Congress appropriated the funds for this coming school year, and President Donald Trump signed the budget in March. The release of the funds, announced just hours before Education Secretary Melinda McMahon was scheduled to meet with the nation's governors in Colorado Springs, Colorado, comes as superintendents nationwide were preparing to eliminate services like literacy and maths coaches, according to a survey conducted by AASA, the school's superintendent association. Half of the 628 chiefs who responded from 43 states said they would have to lay off staff who work with special education students if the funds weren't released. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten brought the message to attendees at the union's National Teach Conference in Washington, D.C. "The administration backed down and we are getting the money," she said to a cheering audience. "Those of you who lobbied yesterday, thank you. Those of you who brought the lawsuit, thank you." So they got their money, but not before they had to cut a lot of programs. That's the end of the article. Had to cut a lot of programs and inconvenienced many, many people. People lost their jobs, that sort of thing, just because Linda McMahon wanted to play around with the education budget that had already been approved and signed off. Now, we're going to talk to you about another group who has been keeping track of hate groups in America since the late 70s, early 80s. They're called the Southern Poverty Law Center, based in Montgomery, Alabama, and they're known for legal cases against white supremacist groups and that sort of thing. They keep track. They have a thing called a hate map, which plots out the rise and locations of many of the American hate groups that are now, basically have been growing since Trump came to power. They cover anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQIA+, anti-Muslim, anti-governmental general, anti-Semitism, Christian identity, Christian supremacy, conspiracy propagandists, constitutional sheriffs, they're people who believe that basically the local county should be in charge of everything, general hate, which is an interesting category, hate music, the Ku Klux Klan, male supremacy, which is a new thing, militia, well, maybe not a new thing really, neo-Confederate and neo-Nazi groups, neo-Volkish, racist skinheads, radical traditional Catholicism, sovereign citizens movement and white nationalist movements. So they keep track of all those on a thing called the hate map at the SPLC, very worthwhile. Now, one of the people they've been tracking is a group called, well, there's Christian right movements everywhere. Mark Kierbleba has been doing a lot in Texas, I believe. The story of, well, I'm firstly going to go to the Network for Public Education, which has done a story based on one of their articles. It's called Mark the pronunciation terrible, K-E-I-E-R-L-E-B-E-R, Kierbleba. 28 bills, 10 commandments, and one source, a Christian right bill mill. So this article is about the growth in power of the Christian nationalists right across the states, and how it's affecting schools is particularly important because schools, the children are the future, as we know. And the article begins, writing for the 74, Mark Kierbleba takes a deep dive into the spread of legislation aimed at injecting religion into US classrooms. Political operative David Barton held up a thick Bible with years of wear on its dark brown cover and proclaimed its pages put Protestant Christianity at the centre of the country's very foundation. "This is actually printed by the official printer of Congress," said Barton, a best-selling author and influential far-right Christian nationalist. Barton has spent the last 40 years arguing that the separation of church and state is a myth and has built multi-million dollar media and lobbying operation to influence public opinion and shape laws around the belief that the United States was founded as a Judeo-Christian nation. At this particular hearing in April, Barton appeared before the Texas House Education Committee and testified in favour of legislation, since signed into law, requiring that posters of the Ten Commandments be placed in every classroom in the state's nearly 9,100 public schools by September. With him, Barton put a small collection of books he claims were foundational to the country's public education system until the 20th century. Barton isn't just a primary pitchman for the Ten Commandments law in Texas, his home state. An investigation by the 74 reveals his fingerprints appear on 28 bills that have cropped up before the legislatures in 18 states this year. A data analysis of the bills exposes how their language, structure and requirements are inherently identical. In dozens of instances, they match model legislation pitched by Barton verbatim. At the Texas hearing, Barton's eyes fixated on the cover of the rare 1782 Aitken Bible. It also says, "It's a neat edition of the Holy Scriptures for the use of schools," he continued. "It has the Ten Commandments." In actuality, Barton lifted language from Philadelphia printer Robert Aitken, calling on Congress to sanction a Bible that could also be for the use of schools. Christian nationalists have for years falsely claimed the revolutionary era printing includes a government promotion of Christianity. Barton has long been accused of taking historical quotes out of context, and in 2012 the Christian publisher of his best-selling book on Thomas Jefferson ceased its production because basic truths were just not there. Now, I'm actually going to the source article for that story, which was in NPE, Network of Public Education. I'm just going to pick from it because it's quite a long article on David Barton. And this guy is just emblematic of what's going on in the United States. There's a lot of people like him, many of them funded by very large organisations run by billionaires. The article doesn't have an author, but it's by the SPLC, as I mentioned before, the Southern Poverty Law Centre, so the group that keeps track of the hate groups. So it says, named by Time in 2005 as one of the nation's 25 most influential evangelicals, David Barton has spread the damaging idea that the separation of church and state is a myth. His historical writings have helped provide a respectable veneer for the rise of radical right religious ideology over the past several decades. Barton has long promoted the idea, now widely popular among the religious right, that the Founding Fathers never intended the separation of church and state, but instead sought to construct a Christian nation. Historians and scholars across the political and religious spectrum have panned Barton's version of US history, which supports his religious nationalism, for what they claim are its many fundamental inaccuracies. So much so that the publisher of Barton's The Jefferson Lies said in 2012 he was pulling the book. Even though such criticism would usually end the career of an academic historian, Barton's Texas-based group, Wall Builders, sells an abundance of books and DVDs pushing Barton's vision, while his ideological history has found a new life in Rick Green's Patriot Academy. Barton should be seen less as a serious historian than as a political operative and a cultural warrior. He has been a political consultant to the Republican National Committee and served as vice chairman of the Texas Republican Party. Barton has also demonised LGBTQIA plus persons and communities, arguing that HIV and AIDS are God-given consequences for living out one's LGBTQIA plus life. I'm not going to read his words because there's a lot of quotes from him and they're just a bunch of hate. So I'm going to go through to his background. And it says, though he has no academic credentials in history, Barton founded a company in 1987 called Specialty Research Associates, Inc., whose stated goal was to do historical research relating to America's constitutional, moral and religious heritage. In 1988, Barton took that mission and founded Wall Builders, a non-profit organisation that promotes Barton's view through recordings, books, training and curricula that the United States was founded as a Christian nation and therefore cannot survive without biblical values guided by legislation, policy and the broader culture. Barton speaks with great confidence, citing original documents from the nation's founders and modern statistics to argue that a turn to secularism and the abandonment of biblical values as he understands them has led to a crisis in the United States. This confidence, however, distracts from a long and serious track record of misusing quotations, statistics and sources. One well-known example is Barton's claim that President John Adams supported religious control of the US government. To make that point, Barton quoted the following passage from a letter to Benjamin Rush, a signer for the Declaration of Independence from Adams. "There is no authority, civil or religious," this is the quote, "there can be no legitimate government but what is administered by this Holy Ghost. There can be no salvation without it. All without it is rebellion and perdition and, or in more orthodox words, damnation." This quote makes Adams into an advocate of religious nationalism, which is only possible because Barton omits the next part of the quote, in which Adams seems bewildered by those who would subscribe to such religious absolutism. He says, the next part of the quote is, "all without it is rebellion and perdition, or in more orthodox words, damnation, although this is all artifice and cunning in the secret original in the heart. Yet they all believe it so sincerely that they would lay down their lives under the axe or the fiery faggot for it. Alas, the poor, weak, ignorant dupe, human nature." So that's the full quote, which is actually pointing to the fact that religious people are poor, weak, ignorant and duped. Barton's approach here is called proof texting, a method in biblical scholarship that uses quotes out of context to make one's point. His discussion leaves out the larger context of the letter, as well as discussion of Adams and Rush, which they believed in their relationship, what they believed and their relationship. But as historian John Fair has stated, Barton often fails to take such care. Fair writes, "Barton calls his historical method a best evidence approach. This way of dealing with evidence allows him to let the founders speak for themselves, but it rarely explores deeply the context in which such words were uttered." And there's a long series of, I'm just going to skip over the next bit, a long series of historians individually picking at his work. Getting to the point, I'm going to skip right through to the article, and I highly recommend you check it out on splcentre.org. Just Google that and Barton. Christian supremacy is what he's seeking, and here he's as a political operative. Rather than as an historian or even a lawyer, Barton is better seen as a Republican political operative, as researcher Frederick Clarkson has described him, and as a culture warrior who is deeply committed to right-wing theology and seems focused not on accurate historical writing, but instead on rewriting the norms of government and culture in a decidedly Christian supremacist direction. He writes history to achieve political realignment, where his understanding of Christianity is supreme over policy, public morals and US culture in general. I'm not going to go through any more, but take it from me, he's known for his anti-Semitism, his anti-LGBTQIA+ stance, his anti-Muslim stance, and a lot of his work is focused on getting Christianity into education. So I'm just bringing this stuff to your attention. I highly recommend you take a look at it yourself if you get the chance. This is part of the moral sickness that's going on in the United States at the moment. It is absolutely unfathomable how they allowed these group of right-wing Christian nuts to take over in the United States. And Project 2025 is well underway of dismantling the American government, unfortunately, in my opinion. That is editorial. With that, I think you've got enough to chew on. I'm going to send you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you a very, very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Well, thanks so much for that, Jeff. And now we're moving into our positive part of the program. Here's a press release from the Australian Education Union, and I'll pass you over to Andy for that.
Delivering an election victory for public education. And this article was originally published in the Australian TAFE Teacher Winter 2025 and written by Karina Haythorpe, the AEU Federal President. When the Albanese government announced in November 2024 that free TAFE would be made permanent, it was a major breakthrough for public vocational education and a clear division between the two major political parties. It was an historic commitment and one that acknowledged both the transformative power of TAFE and the hard-fought campaigning by AEU members across the country. It was also a moment that underscored the power of the union movement and the strength of the Rebuild with TAFE campaign. when Minister for Skills and Training, the Honorary Andrew Giles MP, introduced the Free TAFE Bill in November 2024, the AEU publicly endorsed the bill, calling on the opposition and crossbenchers to support Free TAFE and encouraged submissions to the Senate Committee inquiry into Free TAFE, ensuring members' voices were front and centre. AEU Federal Secretary Kevin Bates and AEU Federal TAFE Secretary Angela Dean also appeared before that committee to present the benefits of permanent free TAFE. Coalition members, including then Shadow Education Minister Sarah Henderson and current opposition leader Susan Ley, flagged their intent to cut this crucial funding, with Ley calling free TAFE a flop. In the final sitting week before the election was called, with support from the Greens and crossbench Senators David Pocock, Fatima Payman and Jackie Lambie, the Free TAFE Bill 2024 passed the Parliament on the 26th of March 2025, guaranteeing 100,000 free TAFE places a year from 2027. This is a victory for students, TAFE teachers, the Rebuild with TAFE community and public TAFE as a whole. Free TAFE is an important milestone in the effort to rebuild with TAFE and allows members to now focus on the next steps. Positive pathways. Under the Albanese government, there has been a reinvigoration of the TAFE sector as a whole. We have seen increased funding for TAFE through the National Skills Agreement, TAFE centres of excellence being established around the country in key areas of skill shortage, increased enrolments and additional supports for people from priority cohorts, and incentives to help people finish their studies, such as accessing Commonwealth prac payments from 1st of July for eligible TAFE students undertaking mandatory work requirements as part of their Diploma of Nursing Studies. This renewed commitment to TAFE is delivering opportunity, skills and career pathways to hundreds of thousands of students. This wasn't a win that came out of nowhere. It was the result of years of work by AEU members who have fought to put TAFE as the public provider at the heart of vocational education. It was also the result of one of the most powerful and visible campaigns we have run. Hearts for TAFE. The AEU's Rebuild with TAFE campaign was a defining feature of the 2025 federal election, and the election results made one thing very clear. Australians support TAFE. Throughout the federal election campaign, AEU members mobilised around the Rebuild with TAFE campaign. You letterboxed, spoke to your communities, and made clear that voters faced two options. Keep building a strong public TAFE system under Labor, or see it dismantled once again under a coalition government. In the first weekend of the campaign alone, members letterboxed thousands of homes across the country, armed with Rebuild with TAFE flyers and stories of how TAFE was changing lives and strengthening communities. The campaign ensured voters understood exactly what was at risk: a $1.5 billion coalition funding cut, a return to failed Howard-era technical colleges, and a renewed push for privatisation of vocational education. The public listened, and Australians voted decisively to protect free TAFE and to ensure it remains a permanent part of our education system. TAFE changes lives. The Rebuild with TAFE campaign didn't only promote the benefits of free TAFE, it showed how TAFE has changed lives. It told the stories of TAFE teachers sharing what secure jobs and strong enrolment numbers mean for their futures. Students could share how their lives were transformed through accessible, affordable training, and the result was voters saw the value of investing in public education and made their voices heard at the ballot box. The Rebuild with TAFE campaign helped shape the national debate and influence the outcome of the election. It demonstrated what's possible when TAFE teachers, union members and communities come together with a shared vision for public education. In the months ahead, AEU National TAFE Council Executive will determine the next phase of the campaign, which will keep fighting for increased long-term investment in TAFE to meet growing student demand, secure permanent well-paid jobs for TAFE teachers and protection of TAFE's role as the anchor of Australia's vocational education system. Further ahead, in 2025, federal government student debt relief and the legislation of the Australian Tertiary Education Commission, ATEC, will have significant impacts for TAFE teachers, with the legislation of ATEC likely to influence the policy settings for both the prices of qualifications as well as curriculum and course design. Through Jobs and Skills Australia, the federal government has demonstrated a commitment to tripartism by engaging with unions and industry, and the AEU will continue to fight for these campaign objectives and ensure that the voices of members influence policy debate as these changes unfold. This includes the Prime Minister's recent announcement to convene a roundtable to support and shape the government's growth and productivity agenda. Just as TAFE was central to the Jobs and Skills Summit in 2022, there is a significant place for TAFE to contribute to Australia's productivity and to the upcoming roundtable. TAFE has changed lives, and the federal election proved just how much Australians value it. To every member who knocked on a door, handed out a flyer, shared a post, spoke to their community, or stood up for TAFE in any way, this victory is yours. Thank you for rebuilding with TAFE, and thank you for showing the country what a powerful force public education can be. Now it's time to not only continue rebuilding TAFE, but to ensure TAFE is fully supported to continue to deliver world-class vocational education into the future. And back to you.
Thank you so much, Andy. And now we're on to our favourite segment of the program, our Great State School of the Week.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Creswick Primary School. Creswick Primary School is in a rural township located approximately 20 kilometres along the Midland Highway from the larger regional city of Ballarat. At Creswick Primary School, we offer a range of interventions and extra programs to support our students with their learning and social development. Breakfast Club. Our school is lucky enough to run a breakfast club on Tuesday and Friday mornings in our multi-purpose building. Students can choose from Vitabrits, porridge, Cheerios, fruit toast, cheese toasties and milk or Milo. We have student breakfast club helpers who set up the tables and chairs for students who attend. Gardening Club. Our student gardening club is made up of students from all year levels in the school. Students apply to be part of the club at the beginning of the year and complete projects together throughout the year. They enjoy completing projects all around the school, including planting and growing vegetables and fruits in our raised garden beds and maintaining our school grounds by pruning, pulling out and planting different things. Hands-on learning. The hands-on learning program is conducted one day a week with a selected group of students from grades 5 and 6. This program allows students to work on school and individual projects. The program engages students in real-life learning, where students plan, budget, and create projects for the school community. Teamwork, goal setting, trial and error, and learning about workplace safety are core aspects of the program. Students on the program meet each Thursday and can be seen creating planter boxes, gardening, putting together shelving, and other projects around the school. Learning interventions. Small group interventions are conducted across the school in a variety of curriculum areas and year levels. QuickSmart, maths intervention program for middle years students in 3 to 6. Students participate in short, sharp lessons that help improve their basic number facts and four processes understanding. Leveled literacy intervention. Literacy intervention where students participate in reading, writing and learning about phonics sessions. Tutoring. We have a whole school tutor who works 4 days a week. Our tutor will work with students identified in a range of areas based on need. And now some facts and figures from ACARA. The school has 155 students, and the ICSEA value of the school is 998. This puts 11% of students in the highest quartile of parental incomes, 21% in the next quartile, and 32% in the third quartile, that's below 50%, and 36% in the most disadvantaged quartile of parental incomes. 6% of the students speak a language other than English, and 3% are Indigenous. It costs the taxpayer $15,905 to educate a student at this school. The school receives $590,000 from the federal government and $2.1 million from the state government, $37,500 from fees, and $34,000 in private fundraising. There's been only $88,000 for capital grants in the last 3 years, and the NAPLAN results just fine.
Well, congratulations to Creswick Primary School. You are our Great State School of the Week. And that's all we have time for today. Jean will be back next week. But if you'd like to find out more about the dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. That's www.adogs.info. But from me, Dale, Andy, Jeff and Sorrel and Jean, Until next week, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.